It is Monday, November 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe seems headed for impeachment after ignoring a resignation deadline. One of the most notorious killers of the 20th century dies at the age of 83, and the premiere of a new film is delayed because of the legal troubles swirling around Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. It's all ahead. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has ignored a Monday noon deadline to either step down or face impeachment. Mugabe made clear in a televised speech Sunday that he did not intend to resign. In a national address, Mr. Mugabe acknowledged criticisms leveled against him by the ruling ZANU-PF party, the military, and the public, but said he did not consider them a challenge to his authority. Mr. Mugabe was removed as party leader Sunday and replaced by sacked former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Chris Mutsuvangwa, chairman of Zimbabwe's War Veterans Association and who has been a leader, is seeking Mr. Mugabe's ouster, told British television Mr. Mugabe cannot be counted out just yet.
And he has actually indicated that he is around and is very much still in the game because he said he is going to preside over the upcoming ZANU-PF Congress next month. So it means that the expectations that many had have not been met. And it seems that he is now moving. He is, you know, what many would call a wily fox. He has got so many lives. He might survive and make one last plan to come back from this position where he is not down, but he is not out.
Mutsvanga said Zimbabwe's generals believe they can work with Mr. Mugabe and ease him out by next year. But he said the longer he remains in office, the more unpredictable he will become, and he could even mount a comeback. John Campbell, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, is not surprised Mr. Mugabe is not going quietly. In fact, he tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this is what Mr. Mugabe has stated all along.
That is that he is not going to resign and that he is going to finish out his term. Now, obviously, he is at loggerheads with the military who now control the country. However, he has an ace up his sleeve, and that is the Africa Union, the Southern Africa Economic Development Community, and most Western states all are emphatic that coups are unacceptable. This means that if the military is going to stick with its line that there was no coup, but rather simply a house cleaning, it's going to have some cooperation from Mugabe. And thus far, it's not getting any. That's on the one side. On the other side, if the military decide they are really going to play hardball with Mugabe, they can go after his wife and his sons, all of whom are deeply unpopular because of a history of outrageous misbehavior.
Chris Mutsvangwa, the leader of the Liberation War Veterans, who have been spearheading this 18-month campaign to oust Mr. Mugabe, said he plans to impeach him in Parliament, which is set to meet on Tuesday.
That would be an interesting development. It is certainly plausible. But the interesting question is, what happens if Mugabe won't go, despite being impeached?
And your answer to that possibility?
I don't know. I mean, after all, what can he lose? He is already under house arrest. He could, at least hypothetically, refuse to acknowledge the authority of Parliament. And after all, his regime for years has operated outside the law. Zimbabwe is hardly a polity that follows the rule of law. Indeed, he might be impeached, but impeachment in Zimbabwe does not mean the same thing that it does in the United States.
John Campbell said if Mr. Mugabe were to agree to become a figurehead president, Emmerson Mnangagwa could be restored as vice president, and assume the powers of president, thereby preserving the military's wish that this not be considered a coup. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, a lot of stories trending today, a busy Monday. First of all, what you were just talking about with Zimbabwe, a lot of talk about what's going to happen with President Robert Mugabe, where he might end up. There was one photo I saw on social media that appeared to show television trucks near the official residence there of the president, so people wondering if there'll be some statement made by President Mugabe or by someone else from the government in the near future. We're waiting to monitor that and see that. But oftentimes now, with social media being so ubiquitous and everybody having a camera phone, we get these kind of hints before the TV announcement actually happens. We see the TV trucks, we see people setting up, so we're going to continue to monitor that. Also breaking just now, President Trump designating North Korea as a state sponsor of terror at a cabinet meeting at the White House in Washington. A lot of questions from people about what this exactly means, the escalating tensions that continue with North Korea, and some praise for President Trump, especially from his base, showing that he is being strong on terror and that he is trying to do something to address North Korea. But that is yet another topic that is a lot of conversation on social media. Then we have Charles Manson, who I know you're going to talk about later on in the show, a leader of the Manson family responsible for a series of murders in the 60s and 1970s, dying at the age of 83. Kind of a cultural icon in a very bizarre way, inspired a lot of movies and writing about these crimes and about the very bizarre circumstances around them. So a lot of people talking about his death after those terrible things. And like I said, you'll have more on that later. And finally, hashtag World Children's Day. It's the UN holiday celebrating children, ensuring their health, safety, and ability to learn and grow around the world. Many people talking about that, including Pope Francis, who wrote on Twitter, "Let us work together to ensure that children continue to smile, their faces serene, filled with joy and hope." UNICEF is, of course, the children's organization within the UN, and they are pulling out all kinds of children to promote their message, including 13-year-old Millie Bobby Brown, who is one of the actors on the hit Netflix show Stranger Things, a very big fan base for that show in the U.S. and around the world. So she is speaking out as a U.N. representative for children. And as many people say, activism has no age, so children can get involved. We're seeing a lot of children get involved as they represent many of the best parts of the world, kind of the innocence and the purity of the world before all of the conflict and strife that we see develop over time. So celebrating those children, celebrating what they're doing already at a young age, and celebrating the ways that we can continue to help them thrive in this world.
Yeah, it's great they're getting involved at such an early age.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The visit of the Chinese envoy to North Korea is being watched closely. The U.S. launches airstrikes in its first operation targeting Afghan opium. The U.S. could soon resume visa consultations at consulates in Russia. And in Alabama, the Senate candidate's sexual abuse accuser said it took her decades to regain confidence in herself. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have learned over many years that the sun goes through a roughly 11-year cycle of being active to less active. When the sun is most active, with a growing number of sunspots, coronal mass ejections, and blasts of solar flares, this is called a solar maximum. And when the sun becomes calmer, with not as many sunspots and solar activity, this is called the solar minimum. A new study from Japanese astronomers have determined that while the degree of the sun's activity varies during a solar maximum, there was very little variation in activity for each solar minimum observed for the last 60 years. Studying microwave transmissions from the sun over the last five cycles of solar minimums, the astronomers found the level of microwaves have been the same each time, unlike during the solar maximums. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear how the presidential pardon for Thanksgiving turkey has a very long tradition. One of the most notorious serial killers in U.S. history, Charles Manson, died late Sunday at the age of 83 after 4.5 decades in prison. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation said Manson died of natural causes at a hospital in Kern County. Manson and six of his associates were jailed in 1971 for a series of 7 grisly murders in the Los Angeles area over 2 nights in 1969. 3 others of his followers were later jailed for crimes linked to Manson. I spoke with VOA Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan, who lived in Southern California at that time. He told me about the followers that Manson assembled.
It was a group that called themselves the Family, and they were just one of many groups of young people in Los Angeles, sort of centered on Sunset Strip, and in the case of the Manson people, they rented an old movie set, a ranch that was north of Los Angeles. But they were just one of many groups of people who were experimenting with vegetarianism and various kinds of Eastern religions and communal living. And in this case, you know, it was a kind of pathological group, but they were really indistinguishable from a lot of the young people in this sort of era of peace and love and anti-establishment and anti-Vietnam War feeling.
Well, now, as I understand it, Manson tried to get a recording contract with the record producer Terry Melcher, who happened to be the son of actress Doris Day. And apparently Melcher turned him down, and he was very angry at that and decided he wanted to get even with Melcher. So he decided to order, I guess you could call, an attack on Melcher's home, which, unbeknownst to him, Melcher had rented that house out to actress Sharon Tate and her husband, movie producer Roman Polanski.
Apparently, that was what happened, and there were a series of 7 murders, and an elderly couple, a retired couple, was murdered in their home in a nice park-like area of the city, quite a few miles from the Sharon Tate home.
Sorry, Mike, is that the LaBianca murders?
That's right. That was the LaBiancas. And police at first couldn't figure out a connection. And in fact, the LaBiancas, I believe, were just a random killing. Just the idea that his idea was apparently in their case that he wanted to start a race war. And he was trying to make it look as if, you know, the assailants, the killers had been black. And now, but apparently there was also this element of revenge in the targeting of the home that Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate were renting.
Well, in addition to, you know, there are several horrific elements of this. Sharon Tate was pregnant, heavily pregnant with a child, and was stabbed to death. And also, what was very strange was that apparently Manson, even though he ordered this killing, was not on the premises when it took place.
Apparently not. And the thing is, he was behind all of it. There was no question, and that came out of the trial. But he was, he was a very smart, cagey character, and he had the strange kind of control over the group. And he manipulated and used them, and he gave orders, and they carried them out.
Well, you were living in this area then. What was the atmosphere like around the time of the killings, and people would have been, you know, so nervous as to what was going on?
Well, they were, and of course, nobody could figure out what was happening. These were just horrific murders. And Los Angeles, has generally been a pretty peaceful city at that time, at least. Now, there had been race riots, and in the inner city there have been serious crimes, but this kind of brutal carnage was something that really shocked everybody. And again, the young people who flooded to San Francisco and Los Angeles, people like the young people of the Manson family, were talking about peace and love, and they were anti-war. And so this was especially shocking when the news came out about who was behind these killings.
Well, Manson spent the rest of his life, he was convicted, and spent the rest of his life in prison. He tried a number of times to get parole. He was denied that. And I have read that Sharon Tate's family, first her mother, and then eventually after her mother died, her sister, were very involved in making sure that Manson never got out of prison again.
Yeah, and there was never any chance that he would be released. And, you know, of course, you could say technically he wasn't directly involved in the murders in a way that could be proven. But, you know, there was just There was no question through the trial that he was behind this. He ordered them, and that he would never be released.
VOA Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan. The annual pardoning of White House turkeys each year by American presidents is an interesting tradition leading up to the Thanksgiving holiday. It's said that President Abraham Lincoln's clemency for a turkey was the origin for the pardoning ceremony that's now so well publicized. VOA's Nicoletta Illich has this report about the turkeys that are given to American presidents.
There are a lot of stories about the beginning of turkey pardoning for Thanksgiving, says the chief historian of the White House Historical Association, Edward Langell. Some of them, he says, date back to Abraham Lincoln during America's Civil War.
He had a son named Tad who joked with Abraham Lincoln about this pet turkey that he had who was strolling around the voting booths in 1864, and Abraham Lincoln asked him, why is he strutting around? Is he here to vote?
And Ted answered that his turkey could not vote because he was too young.
Therefore, Abraham Lincoln pardoned this turkey and forgave him from the possibility of being killed for the Thanksgiving table.
When Harry Truman was president in the 1940s, he began letting the Thanksgiving turkey go free. Almost 20 years later, in a well-documented occasion, President John F. Kennedy decided to spare a turkey brought to the White House for the Thanksgiving table. Kennedy said, "No, I think I'll pardon this turkey and let it grow."
We know that John F. Kennedy definitely began this tradition and has continued on and off ever since.
Today, the White House gets its turkeys with help from the National Turkey Federation.
There's been an official White House turkey reception ceremony, really since Harry Truman was the first to have a public ceremony.
The procured turkeys are pardoned and often sent to a petting zoo in the vicinity. But the turkey cooked for the president's meal is bought with his own money and prepared according to his taste and that of his family. Nicoletta Illich, VOA, Washington, D.C.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. A new film starring Oscar nominee Benedict Cumberbatch, The Current War, looks at the conflict between inventor Thomas Edison, industrialist George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla at the dawn of the electric age. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film was originally slated to be released this week, but has been pushed back to next year because of the ongoing sexual harassment scandal surrounding its producer, Harvey Weinstein.
Benedict Cumberbatch plays Thomas Edison in The Current War. Edison, the inventor of the light bulb, prefers direct current, while his nemesis in this film, Pittsburgh-based industrialist George Westinghouse, played by Michael Shannon, favors the more efficient, if more dangerous, alternating current. Originally, Westinghouse wanted to cooperate with Edison, but when the inventor skips a crucial meeting because he has the financial backing of J.P. Morgan, any hope of cooperation fades. Benedict Cumberbatch says that he was drawn to the role of the prickly inventor because of the challenge of playing Thomas Edison.
It was the moment when we turned Promethean and created Day Out of Night. that's kind of an exciting chapter of history, no matter who you're playing in. And I just thought, you know, it's a challenge to play such a totemic figure in American culture. And I like a challenge.
Michael Shannon says he tried to play Westinghouse as a multi-dimensional character and not let him slip into an egotistical caricature.
It's inevitable, I think. I mean, if you have some success, or every once in a while you're going to think you're a big deal. But, you know, these guys were constantly getting knocked down a peg, too. For every success they had a failure, you know, and it wasn't always easy.
Nicholas Holt plays Nikola Tesla, a former assistant to Edison, who goes to work for Westinghouse.
He really believed in supplying power and the future, and that being right for everyone to have. So it was, for him, it was something very different. Although the one thing about him that was interesting, even when he was penniless and falling on hard times, he would always make sure that he was very well presented and looking spick and span.
The film has received moderate reviews, with director Alfonso Gomez-Rejon criticized for too much use of Dutch angles and special effects. However, the director says that he wanted audiences to get a sense of the change the film represents.
My thing was to interpret the period, interpret that. Because I didn't have 10 hours to tell the story, so you distill it to something that moves you and that hopefully captures the feeling of the time.
The Current War, released by the Weinstein Company, was scheduled to hit theaters November 24th. However, it has been pushed back to a 2018 date still to be determined, because of the ongoing sexual harassment scandal surrounding producer Harvey Weinstein. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
2.5 years into the Syrian civil war, the Syrian government attacked its own people with chemical weapons. On August 21, 2013, rockets delivering deadly sarin gas landed in Ghouta, a rebel-controlled suburb of Damascus. It is not clear how many people died. Estimates vary from just under 300 people to over 1,700. But what is clear beyond the shadow of a doubt is that this atrocity was perpetrated by order of the regime of Bashar al-Assad. There is evidence that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons against its own people prior to the Ghouta attack, as well as after August 2013. Thus, to hold the responsible parties accountable for these murders, in August 2015, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2235. It established the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and United Nations Joint Investigative Mechanism, or JIM, in order to assign responsibility for these attacks. On October 26th, this independent international body reported that it is confident that the Syrian Arab Republic is responsible for the release of sarin gas in Khan Sheikhoun on the 4th of April, 2017. Such use would constitute a clear violation of international law, including the Chemical Weapons Convention. The JIM also found that the terrorist group ISIS perpetrated a sulfur mustard attack on the town of Umm Hush on two consecutive days in September 2016. In a November 8th joint statement, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, and German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel condemned both attacks. They demanded that the Syrian regime immediately cease all use of chemical weapons and that the Assad regime finally declare to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons all chemical weapons that it possesses. A robust international response is now essential to hold those responsible to account, seek justice for the victims of these abhorrent attacks, and to prevent such attacks from happening again, the statement continues. After such a report, the Security Council and all its members have a common responsibility to protect the international non-proliferation regime and live up to their previous commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.